Episode 10 of Season 17, I'm Lyle Troxel, recording from my mountain home in Ben Lomond, California. And on the line from Emeryville, California, I have Dee Dee Hubbard. Dee Dee, welcome to Geek Speak.
Who are you going to call?
Dee Dee, I hear that you are currently, are kind of still employed by Cisco Systems, but it's terminal.
one could say that when you're given a last day and an opportunity to find a new safe haven within a company, you have to start thinking about all of the options. And many of the options include no longer working for Cisco. So it is quite possible that in just a couple of weeks, I will be on the open market.
And do you want to stay focused in cloud infrastructure or virtual networking stuff?
That's a good question. I'm really more into... I get really jazzed about working with people, whether it's the people on the other side, so like the customers or the product that we're making for the customers, or the actual day-to-day individuals that I work with. I like making the people that I work with better. I like accomplishing goals as a group. So I tend to look for opportunities that present themselves in like a collaborative fashion. So that could be in anything. There are a lot of there's a lot of that kind of community in the DevOps environment.
Yeah.
And then you get that with like small startups too. So I'm really sort of keeping things open right now. Currently making a list and checking it a couple of times.
We years ago had you on when we started having you on GeekSpeak. About a year into it, you left for grad school to New York, and you were sorely missed very quickly. And you've been here in California, though a little ways away, and I feel like I haven't taken enough opportunity to see you personally, but also to have you on the show. And now you're looking for work, and so my muscles tighten up and my spine gets a little buzzy, and I think, oh gosh, you might move away. Are you thinking of staying in Silicon Valley or leaving to like greater pastures far beyond?
I recently went back to New York for a quick visit and ran into all sorts of friends and family, and it is closer to my own in immediate family, so I can't say that New York isn't a possibility, but I'm definitely looking for work still in California. I like the weather. I like the people. It's really beautiful here. You get lots of nature. There's GeekSpeak, of course, and I'm sitting here looking out at a pool, which I don't think I would get in New York, so...
Oh, the facility you live... The apartment you live in has a pool?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. And somebody else takes care of it. That's the best part about your pool.
Yeah.
My pool, I have to do everything. We're about to fire it up again, and I have to climb down to the bottom of the 150-foot canyon where the creek water goes to make sure that during the storms I didn't lose the head of the line and stuff, make sure it's all still functional. And I know there'll be some digging and pulling and sweating and mosquito bites, so I'm not looking forward to that. Hey, you could definitely, stay in California. You could actually move closer to Santa Cruz if you wanted.
I could.
Dee Dee, I'm always curious about this because I know a lot of developers who have a job and then move from that job to another job and then move from that job to another job, never being out of work. And I know that you have a pretty impressive skill set and a master's degree and all that stuff. So clearly I'm assuming, have some flexibility in what you can do.
I've come to realize that I am quite the generalist. I started out professionally mainly working on web applications, websites, and mobile apps. And the last 3 years, I've been mucking around with building clouds from the underlay up in Linux internals, software-defined networking, lots of automation, CI, and continuous development. It's really running the gamut at this point. So I'm not really quite sure if I want to focus on this little bit or that little bit. But there are a lot of like full stack things out there, a lot of positions looking for a jack of all trades.
Yeah. Can I ask you kind of an indelicate question? Because it seems to come to mind quite a bit.
Sure.
The the Silicon Valley space, we talked a lot about how sexist Uber is. And some problems there, and there's been some more stuff in the news about it, but we don't have to go into that at all. But in general, there's this depressing statistics on homogenous workforce that happens in Silicon Valley. You basically have a lot of white guys.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's some, you know, splits of some women. I mean, like in our in the immediate group around me, I think there's probably 20% female engineers to male engineers. Pretty bad. And then, of course, there's not very many blacks. There's not very many Asians, actually, in the company I work at, or East Asians. And we, you know, we're always thinking about diversity and trying to increase our diversity. And then, you know, you, I know you, who happen to be have pretty a big stack of minority lists on your name.
Yeah, I check a couple of boxes.
Yeah, and I'm just curious: does that play into desirability for companies that are looking to make be more diverse? To say, oh gosh, an engineer available who can, you know, check a couple of our check boxes off.
Absolutely. It's actually one of the first things I think about for any recruiters and or people that do hiring out there. Any person of color, queer person, or like gender minority is going to be thinking about that when they are in your pipeline. There are lots of networks and back channels in which people talk to each other about which companies are more amenable to whatever. I hear great things about Pinterest and Slack. They're really doing good work on trying to get their hiring process to where they not only attract and assess people on a more even scale and offer the same sort of challenges to all applicants and try to grade them the same, but also they do a lot of retention efforts internally as a company. So I think last week, while the show was dark, there was a new GitHub project that was going around that was actually talking about or listing off companies that avoid using whiteboard interviews because those can be very triggering and or like set up expectations of an adversarial relationship with you and your interviewer, which are not really what you want to be going for when you want to be welcoming, especially to people that are already facing lots of adversity and uphill battles and trying to get heard and seen at these places. So let me dig that up and we can add that to the show notes.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, it's interesting you'd mentioned, I chuckled when you mentioned Pinterest and Slack, because both those companies were partially run by Michael Lopp, who's an old Apple guy and also author of a couple books, including Managing Humans. His Rans on the internet is his kind of his nickname. And he actually happens to be the brother of a friend of mine, so I know him socially a bit too. And he ran Pinterest for a while as the CTO or something, some technical high-level position, and then moved off to Slack. And so it's neat to see that his efforts, and I know his efforts are in diversity, and he seems to be doing a good job, at least in the sense that those companies promote or seem to spread the word that it's a good place and a good safe place to be. So congratulations to Michael for that in some ways. And if you'd like me to introduce you, I'd be happy to do that.
I'm trying to keep everything open. I have a list. I'm adding all of the leads and everything as they come in. For the first little bit of time, I'm still focusing on getting all my ducks in a row with my layoff, and also as any good candidate in between jobs, I'm trying to brush up my resume and get all the studying done for the eventual questions.
You know, I have to say, I really do agree that the whiteboarding is a bad idea, and the adversarial is a perfect reason for it. And part of that has to do with, you know, we already, I mean, kind of a naive way of thinking about it is the software culture that we currently have is traditionally male dominated, right? And there's a, you know, if you think about different traits that traditional male roles and traditional female roles have as a binarity there, men have more competition aspects to them. And so this whole idea that you start adversarial, like we have a secret and you're supposed to solve the secret, like it's a game, it's a puzzle, it's a sport on that whiteboard, that to me immediately already sets up a dynamic that is leaning more to a traditional male perspective than others. And I try to express this to my colleagues that it's not the right way to go.
It also introduces a lot of bias to enter the picture as well, especially when you consider that a lot of interviewers have their own pet question versus working from a similar pool of questions. And when they're put in the same room with people that they pattern match with, when you talk about cultural fit as sort of a code word for more like me or people that I understand, people are nicer and friendlier to people that they are more familiar with. So people that might match their own background better.
Yeah.
And that if that's like college educated or white or male or insert anything here.
Right. And it really could be anything. You know, you come in an interview and someone mentions like some television show or something, and the other person knows it and responds to it, you immediately have made some kind of connection that's very hard to compensate for. And that kind of stuff happens immediately all the time with everything we do. We are pattern matchers, and we're really good at being biased, unfortunately.
I mean, that's how your brain is built.
Yeah. I mean, years ago, I was thinking that it would be really interesting to do a podcast series just on the interviewing process in Silicon Valley and basically talk to the person beforehand, what they do, then talk to them after the interview, what happened. And of course, it wouldn't be, I decided not to do it because it felt a little sneaky and I don't like to be that way. But if you do have an experience, even if we want to keep the company out of the name, I'd love to chat with you about it, just like what it was like to interview and how you felt it was fair or unfair, or you know, what you noticed about it. Because I think that when you're in the hot seat, it's a really weird situation. I do a lot of interviews. I mean, I do some interviews with people, meaning that they come to the company and I interview them. Or lots of times lately, I've been just taking them to lunch. But I don't like the process. The other solution that can be, of course, of that there's this idea that you've got to solve the technical challenge because you want to make sure they're a good programmer. But of course, the whiteboard technical challenge is not what you do as a programmer. So in any case, I hope that you are not stuck in a situation where you're, you know, defining how a linked list works or something, which is completely and not applicable to what we actually do as engineers.
Yeah, I don't really have to engineer my own linked list much in the work that I do.
Nobody does. All right, let's go ahead and go with the news stories a bit today. You want to talk a little bit about Google actually reaching out a bit in their hiring and such?
Yeah, a news story came up on a similar topic, diversity and inclusion. So Google's had this program, Googlers in Residence, for a while. Google would actually send out engineers of their own onto historically black college campuses to run various classes for the computer science engineers over two semesters, volunteering their time and sort of using that as a conduit to encourage people to get an internship at Google the following summer and hopefully, you know, sort of break what Google saw as a disconnect with people getting the opportunity to interview and move on and become Googlers. Probably from their view, these people that are just outside of what they saw as the acceptable range. Google is known for its interview process encouraging lots of false negatives. So like people that are good that are rejected, and they generally avoid false positives. It's debatable on the outside whether that's a great strategy or not. There are a lot of companies that see it differently. It's working for Google according to how they measure it though. But this program has just been adjusted a little bit. Howard and Google are partnering up to create a space on Google's campus. They're going to call it Howard West. It is a 12-week summer program open to rising juniors and seniors from the computer science department. It'll be hosted right there in Mountain View. I've included an article that talks about this from the person's personal experience in the original Googler in Residence program. And how this piece of information and news from Google, on the surface, it sounds good and hopefully has good outcomes, but also sort of goes against some of its own goals. One of the things that went against the original Googlers in Residence program was that the Googlers that were in question, that went out to the various campuses, they actually had to still do their full-time work. So it's not like Google was donating the Googlers' entire time.
I assume that Google was kind of donating them to the campus and such, or to the location. I didn't realize that they had to keep working as well.
Yeah, that would probably be more effective because the second semester of the program, a lot of these people wound up having to sort of phase themselves out and do a lot of more commuting, and it didn't really work out with their schedules. So like, it actually counted against some of the Googlers in residence. Like this is like something they want to do and what they like to teach and they want to give back, but ultimately it was hurting their own careers. So that sucks. And while at school, like, they would wind up picking like the top performing students in their class and coaching them in the ways of cracking the code interview, and then present them back to Google, sort of as like these well-vetted potential interns and potential Googlers. So it sort of circumvented like this recruiting cost thing that you might have to go through with other universities.
Oh, interesting. So that was kind of the reason why, part of the reason why Google was doing this was to do it as a recruiting thing.
Yeah, they were. So like some of the critiques of this are that one, the Googlers that were sent actually to be on site weren't able to give their all to the actual program, and two, that it sort of sets up this little paternalistic angle, like we have to change you to fit us,
yeah,
rather than trying to meet you where you are, because you have this crop of intelligent students that with like a little bit of oversight and grooming, you realize and you see over time that they are actually good Googlers or good potential Googlers. But the only way that you're willing to let them in, to open the gates, is to put them through extra vetting.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, it goes back to, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but it's sort of a thing that comes up a lot in minority-based communities, that you have to be twice as good to get half as much.
Right. You basically have to stand out so much so that the prejudice that exists gets not ignored, but compensated for. And therefore, you have to be a lot better.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So is this new initiative going to tackle that in a different way somehow?
Basically, what's happening is Google's providing space on campus, and they're going to be watching the process. But Howard's still footing the bill for the students and for the education. So it's really just sort of like Google watching over the program to continue to pick off the top Howard talent, which when you look at historically black universities, Howard is sort of the top of the chain.
Uh-huh.
It has produced a lot of notable black professionals, including our own Senator Kamala Harris.
So this Howard West initiative will basically be Howard stationed at Google headquarters teaching classes in a kind of pseudo-traditional way that they would normally do at their home base. Is that
true? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's over summer, so it's also generally when those students would be doing a paid internship.
Right. So that makes sense. So that's not going to interfere with their normal classwork.
It does interfere with their ability to get a paid internship, though.
Oh, right. That's true. So only people that have the means will be able to do this. It's interesting, though, because one of the tricks, one of the weirdnesses about the software revolution, if you will, and the amount of people involved in it, is that it's been focused a lot in Silicon Valley and Seattle and Chicago. And we basically have not a lot of investment in communities that are more, there's more blacks in, right? So we're in this weird situation where the software companies aren't where the diversity is, if you will. And because of that, there just becomes a feedback loop to some degree. So it seems to me that, of course, tech companies opening in traditionally more racially diverse environments makes a lot of sense, but also moving a whole bunch of college students from a diversity space, well, from a black college, to the Silicon Valley seems to also make sense in some ways if you're trying to affect change in diversity. At the same time, doesn't it feel a little weird? I mean, what would you feel like as a student doing that?
Well, I think I'm in agreement with a lot of people who are more active in diversity inclusion initiatives and equity in general, that mm-hmm. it would make more sense for big tech companies to open campuses and or have more offices.
Yeah, satellite offices or even whole facilities.
In large black communities. Like, yeah. I think Google had a space in Atlanta, but they closed it down in the last couple of years, which is sort of going backwards. So, like, if they opened up places in Baltimore or Atlanta, they would hit a much more diverse audience if they were trying to affect change with black engineers.
Yeah. Was there anything else on that story you wanted to cover?
I included the link in the show notes, and it's good. It's from the perspective of somebody who went through the Googler in Residence program.
Yeah. I misspoke, by the way. I was referencing Chicago as a place where software development could happen, because there's a bit, I like I don't think it's 50-50, more like 44% white, 33% black. But at least it's a major city where, you know, you could definitely put up an office. And I don't know of a lot of the big tech companies out here that have offices out there. But of course, I don't follow this nationally. Okay, so let's talk about Apple. Today, the day we're recording, iOS version 10.3 was released to everybody, which is kind of cool if you update your devices. And you got some information about some of the insides and outs of that.
So everybody celebrate. If you've updated today or you updated a few days ago, since we're recording on the day that it happened, you now have a new file system. The successor to HFS Plus has finally been unleashed upon the world on iOS devices. Its primary feature includes encryption and fancy features like snapshots, so restoring files will be a lot faster in the future or easier. If you also updated your Macs today, or if you haven't, you should, you'll get Apple's version of Flux, or the night shift facility, which tries to block out blue light as this after the sun sets for better night's rest.
Let me get back to APFS is what's called, the Apple file system. And from what I understand, when you update, it actually rewrites your file system on your phone as you do it, which seems a little iffy to me, but I guess they got it working.
Yeah, I think on Marco, John Siracusa, and Casey List's show, External Tech Podcast, they went over how this would work sometime in the summer. Mm-hmm. And they went like into the gory details of what happens. I think
Siracusa, yeah.
Yeah, he's really into file systems. And I mean, like, he's been waiting for this for like 12 years.
Yep. HFS is 31 years old. But yeah, he's been talking about for years how it's necessary. Siracusa is, of course, the author of a lot of the OS X, the Mac OS articles written about every time it was released, basically all the features he'd list out and really do really complete reviews, which are great. He stopped doing that a couple years ago. But his tech podcast, which I do listen to regularly, is called ATP, Excellent Tech Podcast. Do you listen to it regularly, Didi?
I used to.
Yeah.
I listen to it when an interesting episode comes up across the Twitter feed.
Of course, that's partially because there's just so many great podcasts to listen to.
There are so many, and like there are only so many podcasts you can listen to that are more than an hour long.
That's true. So Apple's APFS is also designed to work better on solid-state storage, which makes sense because, of course, iPhones have always been solid state, but also as it moves into the desktop, which I'm sure it will at some point. In any case, pretty cool.
Yeah.
New file system on it. The other thing that came out is, you know, some silly things like being able to find your AirPods. You can search for them on via your phone in case you lost them. I'm curious if they added that feature because people started losing them or not.
From even before they came out, a lot of people assumed that they were going to lose the left one. And it does matter left between right.
The closer we get to the mountain, the more we notice an odor. A disgusting, yet familiar odor. A stench, if you will.
Why would you lose the left one more than the right one?
Oh, it's just my go-to. Like, do you know where all of your left socks are?
It's my missing left sock. I've been looking for this everywhere. I've got one just like it at home. We cats love stinky socks.
It's really just an homage to Ren Hoek and Stinky.
Left sock. Left sock. That's it. These are all left socks. This is where all the missing left socks in the universe go.
I thought maybe you were referencing pop culture that I was missing. Our age difference. I don't know Ren and Stimpy well enough. Anything else we want to talk about the operating system stuff?
Unless you really want to go to the planet where Ren and Stimpy find all the left socks.
This space-time doohickey says if we don't get to the trans-dimensional gateway by 3 o'clock, we'll be trapped here forever.
I don't.
Okay.
Back to iOS, there is another feature that I was excited about, and I can't for the life of me think of, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, Apple did this kind of frustrating thing of having iCloud and also other network attached, like your Apple ID, and they were two different things for a while, and then they kind of became one, but in a way that was challenging if you did it wrong. And of course, under like iCloud services, you can sync different things, and you can get to those access the syncing stuff also under accounts and settings. Basically, there's been kind of a mishmash of ways to find how to deal with your Apple ID and your iCloud. And one of the things that's frustrating for me is I also have a family account because my kids also have iOS devices, and so I have the family plan program, which allows you to share and approve and things like that. And that settings kind of snuck down deep into the iCloud settings. And in iOS 10.3, the release this week, that all that setting has been moved to like its own space. Your app ID login stuff and all the settings of that is in one place in settings in the settings app at kind of a root level, which is kind of cool. And I think they've kind of improved it a bit, which was necessary.
They've done a lot with their online services over the years. You go all the way back to, what is it called? iTools? It's been so long, I don't remember. Their original like file system in the sky. Then there was MacMe, then when you got your @me.com domain email addresses. And
yeah, and I recall at the time you could publish your photo sharing thing only to that, right? They didn't have like FTP sharing for photo output. Very frustrating.
Well, it's because Steve wanted it to just, they wanted it to look perfect every time.
On Safari. But we won't get into that. This week, the WWDC call to action has opened up, so you can actually put yourself in for the lottery of being able to get into the show. And in doing that, as a developer, if you have a developer account with Apple, you can sign up. And if you sign up, you pledge to pay $1,300, something like that. And if they then draw your name, they automatically charge you. And if the charge fails for some reason on your credit card, you get skipped, which is kind of frustrating. We'll see how that goes. Are you going to try to go to that this year?
I thought about it like when I was in college, but I haven't really since.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that was really interesting to me a couple years ago is I actually got in, and I'm standing in line, and you stand a lot in line at WWDC, and I'm in line, and I'm looking around me, and of course, there's 80% white males. And I'm thinking, why doesn't Apple why don't they just choose diversity when they're allowing people to come in? I know that seems a little strange, but it would help balance it out a bit, because a lot of people want to go to the show and only some get in, so they could even it out a bit more. I don't think they're doing that, but who knows?
I think most of their alternative ticketing for WWDC in the past and probably even this year has been what they do for students.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm remembering the keynote video last year. They had like several dozen students that had put out a really cool app, and they clapped them out, applauded them in the audience.
Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and go on to improving our internet infrastructure in the United States.
What can Democrats and Republicans actually agree on?
Nothing.
I think they might agree on this, because anybody who actually uses the internet would really love to have more access to faster and more reliable and better throughput connections. Am I right?
You are right.
So unlike net neutrality, this policy, the dig once policy, would actually instruct people that are doing new construction. So people that are already digging up streets maybe to address water pipelines or gas pipelines or put in new buildings or whatnot, that they only want to have to dig up the street once. So they should add conduit as well as whatever they're putting down there, so that we could lay out fiber whenever there's a new project. So hopefully whenever we get that big infrastructure bill, we would also have the dig once policy, so that in the future you could just more easily run that fiber through when whatever municipality or constituents or residents were ready for it.
Sounds very smart.
Yeah, the only real opposition to this is, can you guess?
Telcos. Telcos don't want you to do it.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Construction people don't mind because it costs a little bit more up front, but it saves a lot of money and time from digging up the street later, blocking traffic, and all that other unfortunate stuff that construction brings.
You know, Didi, I have had this policy on my own residences for years. Anytime I remember redoing some sheetrock in my in a basement space once, and the first thing I put in the walls before the sheetrock went back up is conduit. And I decided to move an electrical line on the property here, an aluminum air-cooled line hanging in the trees, and a telephone pole that was falling into a buried line. By the way, never bury aluminum cabling in underground. That was a bad mistake. I had to switch it out to copper. But in any case, when I laid that, when I trenched it and dug it, I went ahead and bought extra conduit and laid that in at the same time. And of course, I don't know, 6 months later, somebody came to the house and started renting it. And they said, hey, can we get cable over here? I said, yeah, no problem. And the cable company was able to fish a line through that long underground tube. Putting tubes in the ground, it's one of the best things. Feels so good.
Yeah.
And I've done that every time I've ever dug a trench. I just add extra conduit.
I can imagine that the leftover wildlife after the nuclear holocaust will appreciate those tubes as well.
Are Republicans in Congress doing anything for privacy?
They are destroying it yet again. What happened last week, the Senate Republicans, and I say Senate Republicans because it was a party line vote. It went right down, you know, the center. All Republicans, yay, and Democrats, no, for removing a regulation that put forth by the FCC last year under the Obama administration. So they're using that rule that's been exercised a few times in the last 2.5 months. Where they just need a majority vote to overrule rules and regulations that were put forth in the last, I think it's 18 months or so. And then that stops that rule also from being put forward again.
For how long?
So they've been using this, I think it's indefinitely, so you'd have to make a law probably to go around it. So in this case, what the regulation was, the FCC decided that consumers should be notified if your ISP, the people that provide you with internet access, want to sell your information and allow you to opt out. Actually, you'd have to opt in, I believe. So like if they wanted to sell your browsing history per se, so like all the websites you shop on or the sites that you visit for work, or if you are at work and you are looking for other work, that browsing history could be up for grabs for whoever the internet service provider is, and they could sell that information. And with that information, people that are buying it could collate it together and develop better profiles about you. So these are things that the telcos and cable providers are sort of foaming at the mouth for. You can imagine what Comcast would do with this.
Yeah, second revenue source, and it doesn't even have to hurt the customer. Like, the customer doesn't have to know that you're doing it. Like, it's a really nasty situation, right? Because they can make money off of your experience and not even tell you that they're doing it. Before, of course, with the law in place, the regulation, which, of course, you know, regulation's bad from a Republican perspective, but this regulation kind of enforced the companies, like, you can do the business practice you want to do, but you have to inform your customers. Or more than that, you have to ask your customers to be opted in. It's interesting. This is right in line with one of Quincy Larson's. We've had him on the show a couple times. He runs Free Code Camp. An article on how to set up a VPN in 10 minutes for free and why you urgently need one. And basically, this goes around to the idea that if you set up a VPN, all your traffic from your house out is encrypted, and your ISP is not part of the loop. And that kind of is the answer to this problem. Of course, you and I, Didi, can do that no problem. Not everybody can, but I do urge you to read Quincy's article, How to Set Up a VPN in 10 Minutes for Free and Why You Urgently Need One, and it will help you do so. And I'll be in the show notes for today's show, which, of course, is episode 10 of season 17, and then the date of the show is the 29th of March. Anything else on that topic, Didi?
One has to be careful when selecting a VPN that you don't put together yourself. You also have to be careful when you put it together yourself. Like, it's really easy to get these wrong, and a lot of free VPN services are out there, and some of them are sketchy, some of them are not really configured correctly. So this might be a situation where you get what you pay for.
Right, right. And additionally, of course, you can, you know, do a bit of this yourself, but you do need a termination point for the VPN service, right? Like, the whole general idea is that you take all your traffic from one side, your home network, for example, you encrypt it all and you send it to another location, and then it becomes a normal access point again. So at some level, you have to trust that second location. Another way to deal with this, of course, is making sure you use secure socket layer, HTTPS, everywhere you possibly can, and that will help as well. But anyway, the details of this and everything is really kind of laid out pretty well in Quincy's article on the subject.
Yep.
And I agree, Didi, you really have to know the VPN. You got to make sure that they're not doing something that's just as nasty. the private industry, of course, wants to do this thing, and now with the bill being repealed, or actually to say this rule, this regulation being repealed, they'll be able to do that, which stinks, and we have to kind of protect ourselves. But there's a concern about the feds doing this as well, specifically at the border, yeah.
There are a lot of rights that, as citizens of the United States, we sort of hold internally, and we feel are intrinsic to our daily life as, like, as Americans. But there are some of these get fuzzier when you get within 100 miles of the U.S. borders. So one of these rights is currently being, since it's a gray area, I don't know if it's appropriate to say that they're being violated, but they definitely go against what many Americans would feel is appropriate based on how they see and how they view their rights within the rest of the country. So once you get within 100 miles of a border, the Customs and Border Patrol, it opens up more avenues for looser regulation and executive action against the Fourth Amendment, specifically like search and seizure. Yeah. So when you are crossing a border or near a border and you are stopped by a border agent or a customs agent, they can, or they believe that they can, stop you and ask you to unlock your devices. So that would be your computers, portable devices, and mobile phones, and all the information that is on there, allowing them to search. And some have even taken a step one more further than that and asking for passwords, either specifically to the devices or to social media accounts, and then searching those social media accounts for various things and holding on to that information for who knows, indefinite amount of time. I'm not exactly sure how long they hold on to that information, but they can then correlate it again with other trips across the border. So like if you went in the past year and this happened to you, they would remember the previous interaction, and if you provided those passwords and what information you gave up at the border. So one of the things that's important, this is a little bit outside the article, to know as if you are a U.S. citizen, you are not allowed to be denied entry into the United States. They may detain you longer, and they may record some of the interactions that you have at a border, but they can only hold you for a long time and make your life miserable for the amount of time that they detain you, but they can't stop you from entering the country.
Yeah.
So if you were to say, no, you can't search my device, they would probably, you know, stick you in a room for a really long time, maybe not provide you with easy access to food, your family, and or like the bathroom. But eventually they'd have to let you go. But the article that I'm discussing now actually has information about several groups that are suing the Department of Homeland Security over these search records, because there has been a huge jump and an increase in searches of searches at the border of devices.
Right.
I'm looking at this graph where it went from just under 5,000 to just under 25,000. It's really absurd. And there hasn't been a whole lot of precedent set around this issue and whether this should be allowed or not allowed.
So we're going to test it in the courts now, basically.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it on the show before about whether or not law enforcement in general can ask you to unlock your device with fingerprints or with passwords.
Yeah.
And a lot of this is up for grabs based on regulations or legislation that may or may not eventually come about if the Congress could ever get together and talk about issues that are relevant to this sort of technology area. But also like the executive policies of the current administration and the breakdown and sort of fuzziness of your rights at the border. And there are some rights that are afforded to legal residents, mm-hmm. people with visas, and people who are visiting in general. But that gets even funnier. You may, if you refuse, be denied entry and have like a deported back to where you come from, and you would not be able to enter the U.S. for, I think, a long period of time, like 7 or 10 years or something like that.
Miles and I chatted about this discussion a while ago on the show. The border, of course, of the United States includes the coastal regions on the West and East Coast.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a
Yeah. We definitely live in a border zone, 100 miles from the coast, definitely includes all of Silicon Valley, which is kind of interesting. In any case, it includes a lot of places, of course, also the Great Lakes and the Gulf of Mexico. And in general, and of course, all around Alaska and all of Hawaii is included in this region. So it's really important for us to be more clear on what rules and regulations apply and how much power exists by the government, because we are talking about a major percentage of the population of the United States lives and interacts within 100 miles of a border. There's an interesting couple articles about this at the ACLU website, American Civil Liberties Union. They have some information about it, some to-dos and things of that nature. I'll link to a couple of those in today's show. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So just do anything with our stuff you'd like. You can even make money off it. Just give us some credit. My name is Lyle Troxell, and if you do want to search for us and become subscribed to the show, the best way to do that is to search for my name, actually, on podcast systems. People keep on asking, like, why can't I find GeekSpeak? Well, there's a few GeekSpeak names out there, but if you search for Lyle Troxell, I promise you, you'll find the GeekSpeak program that you're listening to right now. We do have, of course, a patron page, and we pull in some revenue that helps us market the show and also helps us cover the expenses. And that, of course, you can learn more about that at geekspeak.org/support. And we have some awesome people that contribute every month to make this program happen. And next week, I will thank each and every one of them. We have support today by our wonderful Canadian correspondent who doesn't have to deal with U.S. border regulations. And that, of course, is Greg Merkley, who gave the title for today's show, Hiring File Systems to Dig Under Borders. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and we thank him for its continual use. I was listening to some old shows when we were on KOSP, the NPR affiliate station for Santa Cruz and the Monterey Bay before it went out of business, and at that time, we had the benefit of having a backing of a radio station so we could play any music we wanted, and we always, for so many years, played through Being Cool.
Eliminate the ninnies and the freaks.
I think it's Twits, but yeah, I like Freaks better.
Oh.
Dee Dee Hubbard, thank you so much for being here with me today on GeekSpeak. I really appreciate it.
Have you backed up lately?
And I'll see you next week.
What's it like working at Netflix Los Gatos?
It is fantastic. It's the best place I've ever worked. I absolutely love it. And if you find anything on our jobs, it's jobs.netflix.com, a site that looks like it might be fit for you, will you please, please, please include me in the process, and I will go talk to the manager because I know you and I know a lot of people at Netflix, and I'd love to get you to take a look at possibly joining forces, because then you'd be able to be on the show every week, which would be awesome.
It's an interesting location. It's like it would be tempting to try to live in the Santa Cruz area again.
Do you work on the open source project for cloud? Do you work on open cloud or open stack? I can't remember what it's called.
OpenStack is like open initiative started by NASA, and Rackspace had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, Rackspace. That's what I recall.
It's sort of built to rival Amazon Web Services and Google Cloud.
Yeah. Basically, the idea is that like any small hardware group could put a whole bunch of machines together, run this stack, and if you used OpenStack as a software solutions for cloud development, you could deploy it on their hardware, kind of like Amazon Web Services or Google, like you just said. Sorry, I'm re-explaining.
Right.
It's interesting, though, because it feels like it should be more popular than it is. And of course, the big companies that invest in hardware don't want to use it because, you know, the Google and the Amazon and the Microsoft, they want their own software solutions to be competitive with each other and then to sell us their services. So Rackspace, of course, is basically a large provider, and I'm assuming there's a lot of other companies involved as well. I had no idea that NASA was involved in it, though.
Yeah, at NASA, they wanted to do more things with cloud-aware applications, and so that's where Nova came from. Nova is the thing that really is the heart of OpenStack or anything cloudy. It would be the actual compute, the machines that you are running virtually.
Is that the wrapper that runs the virtual machines, that manages the virtual machines?
Yeah. So like Nova, well, I guess it also does, you know, all the networking and stuff too, but it you know, like the early OpenStack stuff back when there was more promise and but people were more googly and wild-eyed about having access to the tools to build their own clouds, their own private clouds, or use it. Rackspace wound up using it on their infrastructure, not having to worry about, you know, being on somebody else's system, worrying about private APIs that didn't connect to each other, being able to contribute open source style to the project. But, you know, as anything open source and things that are really big and become infrastructure, things build out and then more projects get glommed on. So there's a lot to OpenStack. It's a lot more complicated than it used to be. And so that's sort of made it a harder sell to some people. But there are a lot of people out there who still really want and need some private compute and networking and storage resources. And the group that I was working with was trying to offer solutions that let you do both, like have a hybrid cloud. Uh-huh. So some things in the public cloud and some things in your own private cloud.
Cool. Kind of connecting those together and allowing you to still use the Amazons of the world, but also with your own stuff. And that kind of makes sense because you might want to use the distribution system that Amazon has for your public-facing systems and then have your databases and such in the internal private cloud network and still use both sides of that effectively. So you don't have to have a distributed system. Of course, there's the big expense with hardware. Hey, Didi, would you be interested in dropping all that and working only in Amazon infrastructures?
I do a lot of stuff with AWS and Amazon for the volunteer work that I do for the Women's Flat Track Derby Association.
Sure.
A lot of our stuff is actually running in Amazon's cloud. So
okay, then please go up to jobs.netflix.com, see if there's some stuff that fits, and let me know what those are, and I will introduce you and stuff. Because like I got a good friend that helps run some of that stuff, and he'd be fascinating to talk with you and see if there's a match. That'd be really cool. So I've got one thing I wanted to bring up, and that is that I spent a lot of time in the last week editing video, and this is actually why we skipped an episode of Geek Speak. That's right, I didn't do an episode, and it's so frustrating because I'm actually relatively regular on Geek Speak. In fact, Miles recently looked back to our 16 and a half years of Geek Speak and found that we have missed 25 episodes in that time, and actually 26 now, I guess, though we have done a couple extra episodes through that time, so it's not bad. That's not a bad ratio. We normally do them, is what I'm saying. We normally do them. In any case, this last week, the reason is I was editing video because my grandmother recently passed away, and I wanted to put together a slideshow for her for Sunday. So actually, you know, we'll go ahead and dedicate this show to Shirley Wellington Bird, who passed away last month. So Didi, she loved the Nickelodeon Theater. You've been to the Nick in Santa Cruz?
No, I guess I haven't.
Oh, it's a great little small movie theater. Yeah, the last time I saw a movie with you was Star Wars, and I think we both left crying. But
oh my gosh,
Episode 3, I think it was.
No. It was worse. It was Attack of the Clones.
It was bad. Anyways, I recall that wasn't at the Nick. In any case, the Nick's this great, art house kind of in Santa Cruz, and my grandmother lived for the last, 6 years or so, walking distance to it, so she went all the time. And so when we were thinking about where to have a memorial service, we thought, oh, we'll have it at the movie theater. And so we did it in the morning on Sunday, and they were gracious enough to give us their big theater, which I think is like 120 people. And the idea was that, like a month ago when we thought of this, the idea was that people would send me audio and video clips and I would mush them together and make some kind of compelling thing for a half an hour. And this took a lot of my time of collecting content and recording people and all of that. And then when in her belongings, we found a bag, and in the bag was 3 DV tapes. And I think I talked about this a couple weeks ago because I thought they were analog tape. I thought they were audio only, but they're actually videotapes. I put the first one in the camera and I pop it in and play it. And it's a wide shot of my grandmother sitting on her sofa in one of her houses and a roaring fire also in view, kind of to one side. And it's nice. Lit well, it's soft, it's nice. And before she even speaks, I see that she's got a lapel mic on, which means her audio is going to be okay. Turns out it wasn't. And she says, the first thing I hear her say is, "I really like being a mother." And I'm like, golden. It was an hour and a half of footage of my grandmother talking about her life and art and politics and being a mother and being an activist and just really great stuff. So I was able to cut that down to a half an hour, a lot of audio repair because it was really quite a bit of noise on it, and a lot of one shot video editing is difficult because you basically have to decide how you're going to do the cut between the two.
Yeah.
Like when I'm editing Geek Speak, you can't normally tell when I've made a cut. You know, I can just clip it in the waveform and not even, and send, you know, wait, you know, kind of do a few tricks so that you really can't clip it in the waveform, you know, do a few tricks so that you really can't tell that I've edited it out. And I don't do that a lot, but I do that a bit. And on video, of course, the video always moves, and so you have side effects. But it turns out that it half an hour turned out to be this really wonderful little story. And I'll actually link to it. I'll link to the footage on today's show. It'll be a YouTube video that I'll put up. I wanted to share with people that couldn't make it. And so if you ever met my grandmother or want to hear a bit about where I came from, you can go ahead and watch that half an hour of this wonderful art historian, professor, politically activated person talk about her life. It's kind of cool.
Well, I mean, that sounds really lovely. I'm glad that you have that. That's a lot of really great genealogical and archiving work there.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that's cool about this tape is that some UCSC student was tasked to go interview someone and write a narrative of their life. And so they recorded her, used the tapes for a while to write their paper, and then gave the tapes back. So the tapes were never used in production of any sort. It was just for her own archives. And I have to say that having that was like a gift to everybody that knew her, just a great thing. And I'm looking forward to a couple of years on her birthday, popping it in and watching it again, you know, just kind of have a connection with my grandmother again. And I have to say that if you have an opportunity to record someone, even if all you do is just ask them a lot of like kind of, you know, silly questions and have them be on tape and do that, I urge you to do it because at some point it will be priceless to you. Of course, it's kind of a little creepy thing to do. I was around the party afterwards, and all these people I've known from throughout my life are there, of course. And anybody that's 20 years older than me, I'm thinking I got to go interview them. And of course, the first thing we all laughed about it because we all saw the beauty of that idea and the kind of macabre aspect of it as well. You know, you don't want to get a knock on the door from me right now and go, "Hey, can I videotape you for a little while?" Because it's kind of macabre. But anyway, if you have an opportunity, I would do it. And as nasty as this is, if it's too uncomfortable for you to do that, it's really easy to record somebody with a iPhone or, you know, something of that nature. And you can put it on the tripod. And sometimes people won't even notice you set it up. Just do it discreetly. You won't regret it, probably.
Yeah. When I was home for Christmas at my dad's place in South Carolina, I just made a couple of simple recordings asking him how he makes the various food that I liked that he would cook up when I was a kid. He seemed to get a kick out of it, so I might expand my topics a little bit more next time I'm home. But
that's a great idea. You can start it, get it comfortable with like something that will actually help you right now, rather than it being some kind of future after death thing. That's a really good idea.
Yeah. So like, you know, sometimes it's like just nice to cue it up and listen to his voice.
You know, we decided not to turn off her Facebook account and turn it into, you know, you can do the, what's it called? The
memorialize.
The memorialize. But once you do that, you can't edit it at all, right? And you can't even log into it after that point. And we have her login account because I was always, of course, managing her tech stuff. So we can log into it and do it and use it. And I'm not sure what to do. Part of me wants to delete it completely from Facebook history. Of course, you can't really do that. But, you know, really close it down. And part of me wants to allow the memorial things to go. And the other part of me just wants to figure out that decision in the future and not do anything with it.
I would say, yeah, let it go for a few months. And, you know, once everything's all settled, then you shut it down.
It lets you decide what you want to happen to yours. I think I selected it would just delete my account.
To be clear, Dee Dee, I still have you on tape a bit. When you pass away, you want me to delete all your social network accounts?
Well, if you're around, then yes, please. But
I'm around, something bad's happened.
But
just give me all of your passwords.
We'll do it right
like,
now.
one of Facebook's settings, it asks you, would you like your page to be auto-memorialized if people say that you're dead? Or would you like it to be deleted? And I said deleted.
Oh, so you chose that as a setting. Oh, interesting. I have my Google account set up so that if I don't communicate with Google for 4 months, my account's contents will be accessible by my wife and my sister, which is also a setting you can do, which I think is a smart idea.